Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. With the midterms just 91 days away, Republicans in the General Assembly are working hard to change the rules. Just this week, or actually last week, the state Senate passed two bills along party lines to cut early voting, increase post-election audits by the Republican state auditor, and reduce transparency when it comes to campaign financing. Meanwhile, in Washington, Donald Trump continues to push for the SAVE Act to be passed. It would require documentary proof of citizenship for every American in order to vote in federal elections. And this election season has been marked by moves to limit press access to some campaign events. Here to talk about all of this and more is Brian Anderson, politics reporter for the Assembly. Chris Cooper is with us, director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University, where he's also a professor of political science and the author of Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina politics primer, and Mary C. Curtis is with us, a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Morning, everybody.
Morning.
Good morning, Mike. Limiting press access, whatever do you mean, Mike?
We're going to find that out from you in a moment or two. So, Brian, I'm beginning with you because I know I lose you at 9:30 for some odd reason. You're going to talk to the governor. I don't know. This show or the governor, I don't know what that's about. Anyway, let's begin with one of the two bills that advanced to the North Carolina Senate. One of the bills advanced on a unanimous, I think, bipartisan vote, so we don't need to talk about that. But the other one gives State Auditor Dave Bolick the ability to audit election systems and controls for each county in the state at least once in a six-year period. He is the state auditor, so why do some people find this troubling?
Yeah, so a couple of notes. The bill is House Bill 958, and that's going to be potentially up for votes in the House this week. And just in terms of timing, I think that's important for folks, is the House and Senate have said after this week, they plan to not come back till after the November election. So presumably, if Governor Stein vetoes this as expected and lawmakers don't return, this wouldn't go into effect before the upcoming November election, unless lawmakers change their mind on when they plan to come back. But to your point of, you know, what is the key provision and sticking point in this bill? Auditor Bolick, he has a lot of power already. He can have 3-2 control effectively for Republicans over the state board of elections, the county board of elections. He's also a candidate potentially on the ballot for re-election or maybe higher office in 2028. And that could present a conflict of interest of having someone oversee post-election audits if they're also going to be a candidate on the ballot. So that's the concern that I have heard. The Republicans have said, you know, we're talking about post-election audits after the fact, not really trying to mess or game the system before the election. So that's kind of been the back and forth criticism on both sides of the aisle for this.
And as a little background, the elections used to be run by the governor's office. The governor had control over this, and the General Assembly, in their infinite wisdom, decided to move it into the state auditor's purview, Dave Bolick, because he's a Republican and they're Republican controlled. So, Chris, was this purely a political move to give Republicans more control, or is it just another move by the legislature to take power away from a governor, any governor?
Why not both, right? I mean, I think this is part of a longer trend in North Carolina politics. We've always had a very, very weak governor, and we've made our governor much weaker over time. This last budget bill, actually, that Governor Stein signed, I think took away 80-some-odd more appointments from the governor's office. So it's part of this larger trajectory. And who's been the beneficiary? Not surprisingly, people or offices that are currently held by Republicans. Most prominently, Dave Bolick, the auditor's office. What I keep wondering on this, though, is what happens in the future, right? We're going to have a day sometime when Republicans control the governor's office. We're going to have a day sometime when Democrats are control of the auditor's office. And are we going to just see another mad dash of legislation to change this then? So it is all of that at the same time, and it is confusing for voters. And I think that may actually be the most important thing here.
So this election law bill that could be passed and vetoed this week by the governor, Brian, it has to go back to the House this week where it started. But Republican Senator Warren Daniel of Burke County says this legislation is not intended to give the state auditor the power to overturn election results, and that his audit would not be focused on auditing election data, but rather on how the election itself was conducted in our 100 individual counties. Has that been a problem in recent years? Have there been problems with how the elections have been conducted?
Well, I think the latest, for Bullock's perspectives, a proven test, he would say, would be look at the Berger recount. I mean, he is someone who campaigned with Senate Leader Phil Berger, as folks might remember, on election night. Phil Berger and his challenger, Rockingham County Sheriff Sam Page, Berger was trailing by 2 votes, not 200, not 2000, not 2%, 2 votes. Yeah. And it went for months long, a month long litigation nearly in that race. And the election happened smoothly. I mean, the State Board of Elections did its job in terms of the recount process. State Auditor Dave Bullock administratively oversees the State Board of Election, and there was concern and calls for Bullock to recuse himself at the time, and questions of whether or not there would be some sort of interference to prop up Berger's prospects. And we didn't see that then. That's not to say maybe something changes in the future, but that would be the track record of close elections while Bullock is overseeing and them running smoothly.
So very quickly on some of these other things that are in this bill. The bill also requires anybody seeking to represent a political party on the ballot belong to that party for a full 365 days. That's up from the current 90 days. What was the impetus for that?
As folks might remember, there were a lot of so-called fake Republicans on the ballot in the past primary election, one of them being Kate Compton Barr running against Tim Moore in a congressional race. Kate Compton Barr is very clearly a Democrat, has long been a Democrat, but switched party affiliations to run in the Republican primary. That's not because she's a conservative candidate. That's because she wanted to make a statement on redistricting state laws and get herself into the news. And so those types of candidates are what I think is the impetus for this portion of the bill. It's worth noting that there have, I think the goalpost, Chris might know the history a little bit better, but it used to be even shorter than 90 days. And then because people were switching so close to the candidate filing period, they lengthened it to 90 days. And now they feel like the same thing is happening at day 91, where everyone is switching parties. So that's why they want to push it back. And it's worth noting there is a caveat in the bill where you can get like an exemption through the state party chair. So let's say you're an unaffiliated voter who's really been a lifelong Republican and Republicans want you on the ballot. There's a pathway for you to get on the ballot, but it must be with like the state party chair's thumbs up.
So where we start getting into some real controversy is the number of voting days and the number of voting locations. The bill slashes the number of early voting days for primaries, for special elections, for second primaries, for runoffs, for municipal elections, from 17 to 10 days, 10 days of early voting. And that's something that Senator Daniel, once again, that Republican from Burke County, says the reason is to reduce the administration or administrative burden on boards of elections and on candidates in elections where very few people vote, which would be the primaries and the runoffs. How does 7 extra days of voting add to the burden on candidates?
Yeah, so I think I don't really know how it would burden candidates, but for campaigns and campaign officials, maybe like candidates and campaigns often go to these early voting sites to make sure that they can get their message out, hand pamphlets, hand flyers. And so maybe that would be a strain on resources if you have to do that for 10 days versus 17. That would be the only thing I could think of that would strain a campaign. Yeah,
but why do we care about straining campaigns or candidates? They made the choice to run. Deal with it.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I can't argue with you, Mike. That's certainly a fair point. But I would say the thing that is important to note is that after Phil Berger lost his reelection bid, I asked him, what's his takeaway after the election? And he said, Democrats like to vote in primaries and the primaries are too long. And there was a bill in the Senate side to reduce all elections, primary and general, from 17 days to 10 days. And Berger, in response to that, said, you know, I don't think this would pass legal muster heading into the November election, so we should just focus on primaries. And one important shift that has to be noted in the bill is there was a provision at one point for it to be 10 consecutive days of early voting. That consecutive word is gone because there were Republican officials who said, you know, if you make it 10 consecutive days, you're mandating early voting on Sunday in all 100 counties. So when we say it's going down from 17 days to 10 days, 10 days is the ceiling, not the floor.
Okay. Mary, some believe that we shouldn't be shortening the number of voting days for early voting because that shortens the opportunity to vote for many folks. We should be lengthening the time, not shortening. Is this, as some have said, a move to suppress the vote?
Well, as Chris had said earlier, can it be many things? They can say, yes, it's going to be harder, not as many people vote in the primaries. But at the same time, you do get the people who are enthusiastic about voting in primary elections. And usually that's folks who are more partisan. And in this election cycle, in which a lot of people are mad at the Republicans from the top down, that it has shown that there's an enthusiasm gap between Democrats and Republicans, and Democrats are more enthusiastic. And you could say that since this state has a history of, you know, a federal court did say that they were going after African-American voters with almost surgical precision in past election cases. And Sundays, of course, a lot of folks have said, folks in the elections administration have said we shouldn't have Sunday voting. Well, traditionally, that's been a souls to the polls day that a lot of Black churchgoers go to church, go to brunch, they vote. And so people might say, yes, you're suppressed. It. And I know we're going to get into this a little bit more, but you can also look at where they want to change the voting sites and the early voting sites. And of course, there are a lot of college campuses where young people vote, and incredibly a lot of HBCUs like A&T. So you could look at all of the evidence and say, oh, yes, it's just about making things easier for the candidates and the election administrators. But the effect is it will suppress the votes of people thought to be Democratic partisans on Democratic voters.
This could be playing into the hands of Democrats who are positioning this midterm election as a fight for democracy, among other things. And Chris, this and other moves, I think give people legitimate reason to wonder if the people in charge, in this case Republicans in the General Assembly, really believe in one man, one vote, whether they really believe in democracy. Because if you did, you would not be making moves, I wouldn't think, to restrict voting, would you? Wouldn't you be changing things to make it easier to vote?
You know, I don't know. Obviously, there's a tension between cost and between access, and between, some folks would argue, between security and between access. And I think the Republicans who are passing these laws would suggest that they are just trying to pass some common sense measures to help with security and to help with convenience. And there's a lot in this bill. And I think Brian noted really well one of the changes. I'll notice another change in this bill from a previous version. I think maybe the last time I was on the show, we talked about this provision that said that Board of Election members could not promote voter turnout. That's now gone, right? So this bill is fundamentally different, I think, in a lot of very, very key ways than the previous version. Also, a ban on ranked choice voting, which was there before, is actually, surprisingly in my mind, not there this time. So they have made some moves. And I think some of these make some sense. Like right now, our calendar for municipal elections is all over the map, and it is confusing as heck for voters. So I think there's a legitimate argument to make that some of these provisions could actually help a little bit in terms of access, the one on the dates of municipal elections in particular.
And we
want to say, though, that the reason why a lot of people have a doubt in election integrity is because that was put out. That was a Republican talking point.
And we have a lot of elections in North Carolina. It seems like every other day we're electing something to something. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about elections and voting and all kinds of things going on in North Carolina regarding election law changes with Brian Anderson, a politics reporter for the Assembly. Mary C. Curtis joins us, a columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast, and Dr. Chris Cooper, professor of political science at Western Carolina University. We're going to come back to some of those changes we were talking about a minute ago in a few minutes, but I lose Brian at 9:30. So there's some things I want to cover that he has to speak to because it involves him. Last month, U.S. Senate candidate Michael Whatley's campaign barred you and others from the Assembly and other outlets from covering an event that Whatley and the Police Benevolent Association were having. I guess Whatley was speaking at it. Police were called, as I understand it, Brian, to escort you out. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I mean, let's just start with facts and context here. So I've covered Whatley for years and years and years without issue. When he was chair of the NCGOP, I've covered him before. I've interviewed him, not had an issue. Then on the campaign trail back in June, I get an invite to an event in Zebulon to go cover. And this is a day after his campaign account posts photos of AI-generated Carolina Hurricanes players. And so the day of the campaign event, I ask him about that. I say, who are your three favorite Carolina Hurricanes players? Because there were three fake Hurricanes players in one of the graphics. So I wanted to know who they were. And then he says, you know, I like all of them. Like, I'm a fan of all the players. And then I say toward the end, like, can you name one Hurricanes player? And then he kind of walks off. And then after that, a campaign person flags me down and then brings me to Whatley, and Whatley says, Jacob Slavin, he's a good representative for the sport. And then I ask Whatley, did anyone tell you to say Jacob Slavin? He's like, nope, we're good. So after that moment and that story that we write, just literally rehashing exactly that conversation verbatim, I do not get a press release. I do not get a press advisory since that point in time. But because I'm a reporter, I keep up with events. I find out there's going to be this event last month in Raleigh with the Police Benevolent Association, like you said. And I RSVP. I don't get a denial to my RSVP, so I have no reason to think they wouldn't let me in. And when I arrive, a security officer says, yep, okay, have a seat. And then a few minutes later, someone within the building says, you're going to have to leave. So I'm trying to get clarity on this mixed guidance between a security person saying, please have a seat. He repeats that. And then another person saying, you need to leave. And then they come to a consensus that, you know, you're going to have to leave. So I go onto a public sidewalk. 30 minutes later, three police officers within the Raleigh Police Department show up and say, you can't go back in there. I'm like, I've been standing out here for the last half hour. Wasn't planning to. Sorry that you guys had to waste your time coming out here. And that was really the end of it. Now, reporters at NC Newsline were also not allowed entry into that event. The Asheville Citizen Times had a reporter trying to cover Whatley in a public building during public operating hours and wasn't allowed entry. So I don't want to frame this as a one-on-one thing. This is a wider conversation and a wider issue that people are having with press access. And what I would say is just if one statewide Republican has issue with the Assembly, look at our profile on Brad Briner that we did just last week. We cover all campaigns, all candidates, regardless of party, and we try to do that fairly, accurately, and contextually.
Well, you mentioned NC Newsline. They were, as you say, also barred from events. And a Whatley campaign spokesperson wrote an email to that publication saying, left-wing activists like you, posing as journalists, already have their narrative written, whether they're inside the event or standing on the sidewalk, makes no difference. They'll publish the same garbage and lies either way. That's a quote. Is NC Newsline a left-wing activist publication? Do most people consider the Assembly to be biased or left-wing in some way?
So I can't speak for NC Newsline. I can only speak for the Assembly, and we try to be fair and accurate. And what I would respectfully say is if anyone thinks this is a left-wing activist reporter, go look at our newsletter this morning in our coverage of Governor Stein, U.S. Senate candidate Roy Cooper, and some of the comments they made at the Unity Dinner. I can assure you some folks on the Democratic side are not happy with our coverage of certain things as well.
Well, it's also a pattern of politicians not holding town halls because they don't want to hear what their constituents think about what they're doing or not doing in Washington or elsewhere. Other outlets have reported what appears to be a pattern by the Whatley campaign, because as polls show him declining against Roy Cooper, according to NC Newsline, he has become increasingly withdrawn from nonpartisan media, cutting reporters out of invitation lists and appearing only on right-leaning podcasts. Have you found that to be the case?
Yeah, I mean, I would say Whatley seems to have two homes these days, one in the Charlotte area and one on Fox News. He's gone there frequently. He has been very active. And the strategic question I've heard from some Republicans behind the scenes has been like, this is a great primary message. This would be a great primary campaign. But where's the transition to the general election where you need to expand the base? So that's the open question. Maybe we'll see a pivot as we get closer 3 months out from the election. But so far, it seems like we're seeing more of a primary campaign strategy than a general election one.
So I know I have to let you go, but the question that you asked him that appears to have made him upset with you was not a political question. It was a sports question. Was it a fair question?
I mean, I would argue that I only ask fair questions, Mike, to everybody. I've never asked an unfair question, but I think it was an important newsworthy event because they kind of forced the issue at the time by sharing AI-generated graphics. This wasn't something I would have normally asked had it not been for that. So, and it had also gotten coverage from other outlets and entities as well. So I'd argue, you know, there are these moments where you want to kind of hear a candidate's relatability. And I've talked to people who aren't in politics who just said, you know, I don't understand why he wouldn't have just said, you know, I'm not a huge hockey person, but I cheer for North Carolina and I'm happy they're in, or just poke fun at himself with some self-effacing joke about AI generated images like that. That was what I kind of honestly expected to hear. And I didn't expect it to become a story, to be honest.
Does that speak to the fact that he's an inexperienced candidate? He's never run for office before.
Well, we have seen candidates make gaffes before who have been very politically experienced. I'm thinking Cal Cunningham with his barbecue grill, Mark Walker with a Waffle House order. So there are moments on the trail where candidates post something that maybe they wish they didn't in hindsight, but it's often more the response that you do to it that tells more, that says more than the act itself. That's the newsworthy thing to me.
Brian Anderson, politics reporter for the Assembly. We're going to let you go because you have a conversation with the governor scheduled moments from now, and I have to let you do that. So say hi to the governor. Tell him we miss him because he's never been on. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Can I just talk about strategy a little bit, following up from Brian? We've seen this. It's the nationalization of elections, the whole sense that from the top you have Donald Trump talking about the enemy of the people. You had Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth barring certain news outlets from covering the Pentagon. And the media is set up as the enemy. And it's kind of interesting because North Carolina kind of isn't that kind of state where that red meat would work in that way, as Brian said. A lot of people in the state don't know Whatley. And so for him to just go on Fox News and nationalize his campaign when he's trying to get elected in a general election in North Carolina may not be the best strategy for helping people, you know, get to know who you are and what you're about. What he said at the end about, you know, he could have made a joke. There's a lot of anger now that permeates our politics, where people used to kind of make jokes. When I started covering the campaigns, political campaigns in 2008, that was a big piece of it. They would make jokes with hecklers or journalists that asked the tough question and show their wit and the fact that they could be self-deprecating. And now it's positing certain groups as the enemy. And unfortunately, the media is, it's one of those groups, and it's coming through. And I think the loser are the citizens of the United States of America, because, you know, freedom of the press, we're there to report and be your eyes. And, you know, we cover all sides. And so I think it's a mistake for politicians, and it's certainly leaving the voters, you know, could they name some of the things that Michael Whatley believes in, or what, you know, just what he's saying, how he barred some reporters from.
So
and this
I
goes
suppose,
for all sides. Yeah.
I suppose it's the right, Chris, of any candidate to exclude anybody from a campaign event. It's a free country, and these people have rights too. The candidates have rights too. But is it good politics to bar reporters from covering campaign events?
Yeah, I think like Mary just articulated very well, it's not good politics. I think it's very clearly not good politics. And I will add, they normally have that right. I think the Waynesville example of Corey Valancourt of the Asheville Citizen-Times, that was, as Brian mentioned before, he had to exit. That was in a public building. So I think there's actually a legitimate question about whether they did have the right to bar him from that event. And I think the evidence, and including the lawyer from Haywood County, North Carolina, said, in fact, they did not. But I think it's bad politics. I think Michael Whatley's campaign, for example, would have been much better off if they had let Corey Valancourt into that particular event. It probably would have been a story about Corey Valancourt, about Michael Whatley comes to Waynesville, North Carolina. Here's the main points he hit. It was a friendly crowd. I don't think it was going to blow up the way it has. And of course, the Republicans listening are certainly thinking about Roy Cooper not calling on right-leaning outlets during the COVID days, and also not allowing some folks like AP Dillon from NC, I can't quite think of the name of her outlet, but anyway, North State Journal is what I'm trying to say, from some of his events as well. So I think there's actually plenty of this going on both sides of the aisle, and I think it's bad for the people, I think, as Mary said very, very well.
Well, that was my next question. Does it really make a difference? I mean, we no longer have just one newspaper and maybe two or three television stations that do news every night, and maybe one station on the radio that has reliable newscasts every hour. That's no longer the world we live in. Everybody gets their news on their phones, on various different platforms, and it comes at them 24/7. You exclude one outlet, two outlets, three outlets, you're still going to get the news of what happened at that event, Mary. So are they just shooting themselves in the foot? Does it really make any difference?
Well, I think, as we all said, it would be much better, because the story becomes you didn't have them at your event. And, you know, if you're trying to drive the base, I suppose that positing the press as your enemy, that's in left-wing or right-wing activists, will work. But in a general election, I think that people want information. I mean, we saw what happened. Mark Robinson, when he was running for governor against Josh Stein, didn't show up to do his duties as lieutenant governor, but you could see him on Fox all the time. And you could say that he wasn't going to win anyway, but I think the impression that people came out with was, this is not somebody that's going to be working for the citizens of North Carolina.
So in response to Michael Whatley's blocking of several reporters from events, Mike Tatish, I hope I said his name correctly, he's an attorney for the North Carolina Press Association, which represents McClatchy, which owns the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, among other papers, called the decision frustrating, cowardly, and inconsistent with the marketplace of ideas, though not illegal. And he added that, quote, failing to allow reporters to report on what is said and done in a campaign's events should promote skepticism of that candidate, regardless of party. So, since Roy Cooper also turned away a photographer from the conservative North State Journal, does that criticism, Mary, apply to him as well?
Yeah, I think it goes always. I mean, I think that, yeah, you should let folks in from every outlet. And yes, he can be criticized for that. I think that Whatley has been a lot more out front at demonizing the press as well as being nothing but a bunch of left-wing activists, but Roy Cooper should let folks also into his events, because that becomes the story, I think. So I think the people should just put it out there. And you'll see, as I said, that when I started covering all of these things, that actually politicians made it work for them, because when confronted with hostile questioning and things like that, or hecklers, they would oftentimes turn it around. I mean, Obama was great at doing this, of engaging people who were screaming at him and coming out on top. Not every politician can do that. They just rather do that, particularly, as you said, since now people get their information in silos. Yeah. So you figure the people that you want to get reach, you'll reach.
So let's get back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, a little bit, Chris. The election law changes in 2024, as we said, the state legislature gave State Auditor Dave Bolick supervisory power over elections in the appointment of Board of Elections members and county board chairs, and they took that power from the governor's office. And now, one of the complaints the Democrats have about the move is, and you, I think you brought this up, is that Dave Bolick campaigned for Senate Leader Phil Berger, who lost his re-election bid, and they object because Bolick is also an elected official. We've talked about how he campaigned for Phil Berger, but the fact that he's an elected official, is that a valid concern? Because the governor, who used to run elections, in charge of elections, is also an elected official.
Yeah, that's exactly right. They both were, are, and continue to be elected officials. I think that's exactly right. I don't think that the concern should be about the fact that he's an elected official. It should be that we got 50 states in the country, and there's one and only one who's decided that the auditor should be in charge of elections, right? It's a matter of alignment of duties, to me anyway, that is much more critical than the fact that Dave Bullock is an elected official. And look, a lot of states have elections run explicitly by elected officials. At least here in North Carolina, we have the State Board of Elections, which is appointed. States like Florida, they just elect their secretaries of state that are in charge of the whole thing with much more power than our auditor has. So I don't think the rub here is about the fact that Dave Bullock is elected. In some ways, I think that's actually better. I think the rub here is about who should be in charge and then how much influence should they be able to exert. So the criticism, one of the criticisms of Dave Bullock is that this position he created for Dallas Woodhouse to communicate with board chairs was new, and that the governor previously didn't actually have any sort of office like that. So I think it's about how they exert that power more so than that person is elected.
Since taking the reins, Bolick has made moves that affect where college students vote and where and how black citizens can vote. He moved early voting sites away from some college campuses, which are full of younger voters who tend to vote Democratic, at least in some people's minds, and ending Sunday voting in other places very popular among black voters. Are these attempts, and I have a minute left in this segment, Mary, are these attempts to suppress the vote or to shape the vote in some way in favor of one party or the other?
Well, I think reasonable people can come to that conclusion when they see how they pick and choose what they're going to do and how they're going to do it when it comes to voting sites and ending souls to the polls, and also considering North Carolina's history of trying to shape the vote, and with a very close Senate race that could determine who controls the Senate, all you need to do is shave a few votes off here and there.
Although that may be decided in other states like Michigan, it looks fairly cut and dry here. We have to take a break. We'll talk some more about these election law changes when we come back, and also about the SAVE Act, which is what's allegedly, well, maybe it may not be happening in Washington because the Senate won't pass it, but the president certainly wants it. And we'll talk about that and more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte. Celebrating 95 years, United Way of Greater Charlotte supports education, financial stability, health, and essential services. Details at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Chris Cooper, Professor of Political Science, Director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University, and author of Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina Politics Primer. Mary C. Curtis is also with us, a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And we're talking about election law changes, among other things, in North Carolina. And you, Chris, ran the data on 80 early voting sites that have been approved for this November's election. What did you find out?
Yeah, so just to jump back for a second, we have 100 counties, of course, in North Carolina, as everybody learned in the fourth grade. So 80 of those had unanimous plans. In other words, the Democrats and the Republicans said, we agree this should be the plan. There are 20 that are non-unanimous. Those are going to go to the State Board of Elections, right? So of those 80 that you can actually analyze that have formal plans, one plan up, it looks like Sunday voting is down. In other words, there are fewer opportunities for Sunday voting, an increased opportunity for Saturday voting. But just to hit the Sunday voting piece with a little bit more precision, there's not a single county of those 80 that added Sunday voting. whereas a dozen counties eliminated it completely, right? So we're seeing a real change in Sunday voting in North Carolina. And these are the ones where the Democrats and Republicans held hands, sang kumbaya, and voted unanimously. Now we still have to find out about the other 20.
Okay. So, Mary, in Guilford County, the home of Greensboro, the Board of Elections there declined to adopt 2026 early voting sites at NCA&T and UNC Greensboro, despite repeated student calls to keep those voting places open on campus. It certainly makes it harder for these young people to vote, but don't most college students have access to private or public transportation to get them to a polling place off campus? They could find a bar to go to. Can't they find a way to get to a voting location?
Every student doesn't go to a bar to drink, but and that's not in the Constitution as a right, Mike. So I really don't think that's a good comparison. Where voting is a right, and a lot of young people would like it there. And not every young person has transportation. They don't all have cars. We're not known as a state for our public transportation. And we even see in NC State that they, put it in a far, it was in a central place, the voting place there on campus, but now it's in a, remote part of the campus. It does seem like, they are trying, and also a lot of students, you didn't say, but they vote absentee where they live. But a lot of students vote on campus and they reside on campus and they would like to vote there and have it be convenient. And studies have shown that most young people, when they do vote, because their numbers are pretty low, that they pretty much a majority of them or more vote Democratic. So we saw a lot of student protests there. And the image of all the Black students at the HBCU with signs saying, please, let us have this early voting site, that's pretty stark. I mean, I do bring up race because, the Supreme Court has said, okay, you can have partisan gerrymandering and partisan redistricting and voting rules. But in the South, let's be clear, race and party do kind of go hand in hand. Traditionally, particularly since the Democratic officials and president signed the Civil Rights Act, and a lot of former Democrats became Republicans. So we can't ignore that. And also the recent case, as I mentioned earlier, where it looked like they said the federal court said that the new voting rolls really went after Black voters with almost surgical precision. So indeed, it looks like young people, people of color, people who don't have money to have transportation to get where they have to be, people who vote odd, who work odd hours and might want to go on Sunday after church. Yeah, that's the, and let's face it, there is no problem with voting integrity or confidence in voting that wasn't ginned up by folks at the top.
So, Chris, you're on a college campus. I don't know whether there's a voting location at Western Carolina University or not, but if there is not, is it difficult for students to find a way to get to the polls?
I'm actually in the middle of the hornet's nest, Mike. So, Western Carolina University had an early voting site on campus, and it had actually been in place since 2016. The Republicans actually Republicans on the board actually put it. It was a unanimous decision. Republicans are in charge. They put it on this campus. And there was another site, is another site about 2.5 miles, a little less than 2.5 miles away from campus. In the primary, they took away the site on the campus. That was actually one of those that was very, very controversial. And so I ran the data actually on that site and what it meant. And it turns out that the county did not move leftward when the campus site was put in. In other words, actually prior to the inclusion of the campus site, Jackson County, North Carolina was much more Democratic leaning and actually moved right about the same time the campus site opened. I don't mean that the campus site turned it red. I just mean it certainly didn't stop it from going red. The campus site also had the largest proportion of same-day registrations in the state. That may not seem like a big deal, but it's actually known as one of the most important reforms we can have to grow new voters. So it didn't seem to have this pernicious partisan effect. It did seem to have a mobilizing effect. And right now, it is one of those 20 plans that were not unanimous and are going to the state board.
Something else the State Board of Elections recently approved are new rules for absentee mail ballots. The vote split along party lines at the state election boards. Three Republicans said yes, two Democrats said no. Under the new rules, voters could have their mail-in ballots rejected if they don't seal their ballot in a specific envelope, even though the envelope that you mail that ballot in is sealed. So in other words, there are two envelopes, and you have to seal both of them in order for the vote to be counted. One Democrat on the board called the rule unnecessary and fussy. Chris, is that the point?
You know, I don't think that's the explicit point. I don't think that's why they're doing it. I don't think they're trying to make it fussy. I think very smart people can, will, and continue to fight over whether that is a common sense measure for security, whether it is something else. I think tied with that, one of the keys is these boards of elections to throw out is even the wrong word, to not count a provisional ballot. These boards of elections had to say, hey, we have to have a unanimous decision. In other words, every Democrat and Republican on the board had to say this ballot shouldn't count because they broke some rule. That will, if this is passed, move to a majority. In other words, the majority can decide with no minority on their side, minority party on their side, to say a ballot does not count. Right now, in real terms in North Carolina, that means the three Republicans on county boards could decide not to count these ballots over the objection of the two Democrats on those boards.
Both parties engage in various ways to make voting difficult or to redraw districts in such a way that people are moved around and maybe lose interest in voting or don't know what district they're in, or they're like their favorite candidate is suddenly not available to them, etc. Both parties engage in all of the activities that we've been talking about. Is one party more egregious at this than the other, Chris?
I think the party in power is always the more egregious one. And in the state of North Carolina, the Republicans are in control of the General Assembly, right? If we can go back in time when I had less gray hair, and presumably you did too, and the Democrats were in control, I think they were the ones that were gerrymandering the heck out of the state as well. So it really is about, you know, you look at what happened in California, who was doing the gerrymandering there, Virginia, it tends to be the party in power. This is a people in power problem.
Yeah. I think now, though, the difference is that the tools are so much more sophisticated. You can look at past votes and say, okay, you know, the people on this side of the street voted this way. And so you can be much more exact and precise about how you draw these districts. Now, admittedly, you know, we've had some redistricting, and to make some of the districts like District 1 a lot more Republican, they've had to narrow actually the margins in other districts. And in a wave election year, who knows? And that's the Democrats' hope, that they can overcome some of this redistricting. But indeed, the tools are so sophisticated. That's why in the House of Representatives and in our own state legislative districts, there are so many fewer swing districts. So many of them are just, you know, what's going to happen, you know, before anybody does a vote, which you could say discourages voters if they feel that their vote doesn't count, that they'll say, you know, whatever I do, it won't matter. And I still think we should really desire for more people to vote in the United States than fewer.
So let's go north a couple of hundred miles, where Donald Trump has been pressing Congress to pass the SAVE Act. That's the Safeguard American Voter Eligibility Act. It would require every American registering to vote in federal elections to present documentary proof of U.S. citizenship. And it would dramatically change how voter registration works everywhere. Ostensibly, this is an attempt to prevent non-citizens from voting, never mind that the incidences of that happen are infinitesimal. But Chris, what would the impact of this extra requirement be?
One, it's not going to pass, right?
Right.
Barely am I going to make a hardcore prediction on this program, but here I'm going to drop one, right? I do not think the SAVE Act is going to get out of Congress and become law. That's not going to stop Donald Trump, though, from beating that drum, because I think it's one of these policies that sort of briefs well, right? It sounds like a common sense policy, but when you dig a little deeper, it could be incredibly problematic. Tons of election scholars have written about this. The most obvious example that people bring up is people who've changed their name, right? A lot of reasons people change their name. The most common one, of course, women who get married. So your birth certificate then does not, in fact, match what your driver's license says and all your other documentation. This could create a real problem of disenfranchisement, even if unintentional, that doesn't really matter. It's still.
And we should point out that presenting your birth certificate when you register to vote is one option. The other option is a passport, which obviously requires a birth certificate to get. And in some cases, but not all, real IDs, which is your driver's license with the little star on it. But not all real IDs are created equal. So that would. But not everybody has a passport either.
No. Most Americans don't. And people say, oh, you need an ID to get liquor or get on a plane. Well, some Americans don't do that. And he just says voter ID. And most people are in favor of that. And many, many states, including North Carolina, they already have a voter photo ID provision. But as Chris says, when you dig into it, people who can't find their birth certificates, you know, I know a lot of people in my mother's generation, you know, were midwives. I don't know if she could ever put her hand on it. She was born at home. And then also a lot of people don't travel. And this affects a lot of poor people as well, that you don't have these photo IDs. A lot of people don't have cars. They don't drive a car. They don't even have a driver's license. And so this really is, you know, but Donald Trump has said that the Republicans can't win without this. He has threatened Senate.
How can he say that when the Republicans control the Congress and the White House, the Republicans don't win without this? How can he say that?
Well, that's how Congressman Massey and several others just said, why are you talking about fraud and everything? We have the Congress, the Supreme Court, the presidency. You really can't say that. But he's also wanting them to do away with the filibuster to pass it, which is Chris said, that's not going to happen. And also a lot of people overlook the fact that the Constitution says that the federal government should not have anything to do with elections. That's the state's purview. And he's threatened actually to put armed ICE agents and federal officers at polling places, which is illegal. So we really have to pay attention to this. I think we're not paying enough attention to how the vote will be counted and who will vote.
So Chris, given all the problems that this presents, it's not going to pass, as you say, because the Senate needs 60 votes to get it through and to break the filibuster, and they're not going to break the filibuster, and they're not going to get the 60 votes because Democrats won't vote for it. So it's not going to happen. But is this really about non-citizens, preventing non-citizens from voting, or is it really about something else, or is it simply another example of Donald Trump not being able to dispossess himself of an idea once it's set in his brain?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'll go back to the top of the show. I think you asked me a question. I said, why can't it be all that at the same time, essentially? And I would say the same thing is true again, right? I mean, this really is all of that. I mean, clearly, Donald Trump gets an idea. He can't get rid of it. He thinks it is politically smart. He perhaps might be correct on that. Whether it is good policy is a separate question, but I think he thinks it plays well. I think he thinks it plays well with his base. And one thing I do trust Donald Trump on is that he knows what plays well with his base. So I think everything with most politicians and Donald Trump in particular needs to be looked at through both lenses. What do they really believe is the best policy, and what do they really believe is politically beneficial to them?
And the chaos is the point, as I think even Chris mentioned earlier, that there will be some confusion. They're even talking about trying to get use flawed federal databases to figure out who can vote and who can't vote, who's a citizen and who is not, and they're very flawed. But this is a lot of chaos. So if the results aren't what some folks who thought they were going to be elected, if it doesn't turn out that way, they can say, aha, you see, we didn't have the SAVE Act. The voting was flawed. It's bogus. All these people who shouldn't have been able to vote voted. And that's, I think, what we also have to pay attention to.
Well, one thing can be said without equivocation about Trump is that he is relentless. He's like a dog with a bone. He ain't giving it up. And he is backed almost lock, stock, and barrel, although that may change after November, by the entire Republican Party and people in Congress. So just like this agreement with Todd Blanche that will likely get him his attorney generalship today, where he says the slush fund is dead, it could come back in another form. Every lawyer I've ever heard talk about this says it could come back in another form. And we have said that the SAVE Act is dead because it can't pass muster in the Senate, and they will not break the filibuster to make it happen. So it's dead. But is it? Couldn't they attach this to a spending bill or a military appropriations bill or something that the majority of people see this, see as needing to happen, so let's make it happen. But oh, let's just slip this in, Chris. Couldn't it happen that way?
You know, it's possible it could happen that way. I'm not sure. I think a lot of the Republicans are very clear that their most politically beneficial move is to have this not pass, right? I mean, these are very real concerns about the types of people who will be turned away from voting if the SAVE Act were to pass. And frankly, a lot of those folks are Republicans. And so yeah. I tend to think this is actually the better play for them right now, is just sort of letting it.
Dr. Chris Cooper is professor of political science and the director of the Hare Institute of Public Policy at Western Carolina University and author of Anatomy of a Purple State, North Carolina Politics Primer. Mary C. Curtis joined us. She's with RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. And earlier in the program, Brian Anderson, politics reporter for the Assembly. Go vote. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.